Hey everyone, welcome to the latest episode of the Humanities Podcast. Stefano Faustini here, along with my awesome co-host Marina Bojanova. Very excited. Today we have a really, really special guest. We have Olga Bojanova, who happens to be someone extremely impressive that we're really, really kind of lucky to have on the show today. Olga is a tenured professor at the Southern Illinois University, Edwardsville, within the Department of Foreign Language and Literature. She comes armed with a PhD from Yale, no less. She also worked at Cornell University. She has two books published, more on the way, I'm sure. A ton of articles, conferences she's spoken, awards won. The list just really keeps going. And just so you know, Olga speaks five languages fluently, and she can read upwards of seven or eight. So extremely impressive. Anyways, Olga, welcome. Welcome again.
Thank you so much. It's great to be here.
Great to have you. So obviously, I know that you had spoken a little bit about this with Marina and about the topic and about what it is we're trying to accomplish with it. With this podcast, you obviously are a professor and academic. Of course, I know that you're passionate about the humanities and you believe in their value. Yet you know quite well that the humanities are dying at pretty incredible rates. Aside from a humanities for humanity's sake of academia focused argument, what do you think can be done to actually help save the humanities?
We're hearing right now a lot of conversations, articles that are coming out almost daily telling us that the humanities are dying, that there is no future for the humanities. What we have to understand is the larger context for the existence of this constant anxiety over the humanities. What's happening is that across North America and Europe, the state funding for universities and especially for the programs in the humanities are being dramatically reduced. And as a result of that, we'll have to create all sorts of ways to prove our continued relevance. And so the state of panic that exists leads many people to think that, in effect, we're not doing anything useful. And this is a huge misconception, and it doesn't really reflect the reality of what is going on in our programs.
But so do you think that, well, of course, funding is being cut for a reason. And you're saying that the reason is that there's no value or reduced value being seen in humanities programs. And also to connect with that, there seems to be the statistics that we're reading that there is a big decline in big drop in applications and students joining humanities departments. And I was reading that there's been, a 10-year row of declines, and it's, 5 to 10% annually, drop below 12% in 2015, and just continuous drop in enrollment. And so what do you think the reason is? Why are students reluctant to study humanities? And is that directly correlated with the funding being dropped, or which comes first?
This is a really important question. At my university, every year I participate in the activity where we invite prospective students with their parents to come and talk to the professors at the departments that they're interested in applying to. And so very, very often I see parents come up to me and they say, well, my son or my daughter wants to major in this or that program in the humanities. But I'm worried about letting them do that because I'm not sure that they're ever going to be able to be employed after graduating from the program. And every single time I tell them, I always come to these events with a list of where our current graduates from my program actually work. And the parents of these students are always stunned to find out that there is a million different opportunities for employment for our students. Our students work in the banking industry, in business, in finance, in criminal justice, in all kinds of nonprofits. They work around the world, and they're actually a lot of opportunities. It's that those opportunities are not immediately visible to people. It's sometimes difficult for people to realize that this is something that you can actually do with a degree in humanities.
That's a really good point, and kind of touches on one of my questions. So in your opinion, outside from, again, a humanities for humanity's sake, that the humanities are great, I'm sure, obviously, I know you chose to study them, so did I. Outside of that, you really do believe that there are some skills that actually emerge that can be attractive to an employer. So so humanities grads can actually get jobs. I am curious to know, though, are they more soft skills? Or in your opinion, do you think there are also some hard skills?
Well, what I teach is the Spanish language, literature, and culture. And of course, for a person to be able to speak, read, and write in Spanish, this is, of course, a very important skill for a number of professions. But even for humanities degrees that are not as specifically oriented towards a very clearly marketable skill, there is also a lot of things that people who graduate from the humanities can bring to the workplace. For instance, one of the things that all of the humanities programs teach very specifically in with a great dedication is how to express your thoughts clearly in writing and orally, which is a skill that is in growing demand. And really, what kind of a profession can you possibly have where you do not need to be able to write well and express yourself well, at least in one language? But usually in the humanities programs, we expect students to learn two languages, so their own language and a foreign language, so that they can have greater opportunities on the job market.
And then how applicable is that if we're talking about soft skills versus hard skills? And I mean, being able to structure an argument clearly and being able to write, I mean, that sounds to me more like a hard skill. But for departments that don't teach languages, for example, so minus that hard skill for a department that's maybe, I don't know, sociology or philosophy, what are the prospects of those students and what can departments do in order to make those students more marketable and employable? And when I say employable, I don't mean just employable. I mean, everybody gets a job, or almost everybody these days. Their unemployment rates are exceptionally low in the US and in Canada, knocking on wood. But to be employable to their full potential and to have careers, not just jobs upon graduation, what can those departments do? Are there skills that they should be teaching? Is it just more a matter of awareness, and specifically on the side of what academics can do and what, you know, universities can do?
It is very important for many of my colleagues to realize that there is nothing wrong with teaching skills. We have a bit of a philosophy in academia that what we do is not supposed to be useful. And to a large extent, that is true. It is great to be able to spend several hours a day with students in an environment where they do not have to think about competitiveness, where they do not have to think about making money. But at the same time, we have to be realistic about the fact that students are going to go on the job market and they want to bring something of value to the job market. We have students who are increasingly pursuing a double majors. For instance, if we're talking about philosophy, a double major in philosophy and medical studies or philosophy and criminal justice is very useful because, for instance, in medical studies, what more and more often comes up is the issue of bioethics. And these are new issues that are going to be coming up. And we need people who are trained and
prepared. That's huge, yeah.
Exactly, who are trained and prepared to engage with those ideas. And the training in philosophy in that sense is absolutely crucial for them. Because right now, the body of knowledge on that subject is limited. It doesn't even exist in many cases.
Yeah, that's a great point. That's something that, you know, we're starting to see a lot more kind of interdisciplinary kind of focus within universities and kind of pairing skills. I know that there's a Boston-based kind of market research firm that is one that I quote very often, but they talk about how they released a ton of mind-blowing facts about how humanities grads after they paired their education with just as little as one kind of interdisciplinary skill, whether it's, like you said, medicine, maybe something in the medical space, maybe it's more in the business end with marketing, maybe it's something on the computer science end with programming. Even just pairing their humanities education with one kind of hard, tangible skill outside of their discipline doubled their opportunities in the job market, and then actually doubled their potential revenue generation. Obviously, again, maybe not primarily motivated by money for sure, but at least opens a lot more doors. So curious to know if you agree with that. And I'd also be curious to know if you've ever actually learned a skill outside of your direct skill set that you found, you know what, that was actually really, really valuable for me.
Yeah, absolutely. The way that the world functions today is that you have to not only be prepared for change, you have to anticipate change. And I'm sure that you're aware that this is absolutely true in business, that a business that is even doing very well right now needs to know that within a couple of years, if it keeps doing just what it's doing, it's not branching out into new fields, into new experiences, then it's going to be very problematic for that business to stay afloat. And it's exactly the same in academia. We constantly have to look for completely new venues of research, and we have to be fast on our feet. I personally find that to be very exhilarating, and it's something that if you don't know how to do that, if you do not know how to reorient yourself, to reorient your mind into working in new directions, you're going to have a lot of problems in the future. And also another very important thing is that today, the students who graduate, the likelihood that they're going to stay employed at the same company and living in the same region for the rest of their lives is not huge. Mm-hmm. Usually people have to be prepared to work in the global workplace. It doesn't mean that they have to move overseas necessarily, although many students do. But you always end up working with people from different cultures. You keep communicating with people from such different backgrounds, different countries, different linguistic environments. If you're completely unprepared for that, if you are limited in your understanding of the world, in how to interact with different people, with different kinds of people, you're not going to be successful in the workplace. And this is one of the enormous contributions that an education in the humanities can provide for our students.
But in what way? How is that something that you learn? Often people will learn that by broadening their horizons and, let's say, traveling. Not everybody has access to that. It's not feasible. But so in a university environment, let's say I'm majoring in, psychology. How can I learn that particular, skill or ability or broaden my horizons to know how to interact with different people and to know how to navigate myself in, a global type of an organization?
At my university, because specifically, precisely as you say, many students come to us who have never had an opportunity even to travel beyond the borders of our state, let alone across the country borders. We make sure that we give all of the opportunity, some opportunity to all of our students to travel overseas in a study abroad program. We push students towards that. We provide scholarships. And also within academia, all of the professors that they meet tend to come from someplace else. And even that is an educational opportunity. We always attract to our programs international students. And so every classroom is a sort of a microcosm of what the future workplace looks like, because mm-hmm. a classroom contains so many people who come together to talk about issues that have to do with life, politics, culture, art, the economy. And so you have to participate in those discussions and not just, solve mathematical problems, as important as that is, but also because the education in the humanities is also about having discussions. We do not have large lecture classes. It's all about talking. It's all about engaging, interacting. And so whether you want it or not, you get a lot of practice in that in a humanities classroom.
And so what you're saying is that, because I would imagine then, and at your university, if we take as an example, and of course, very similar in Montreal, also because it's extremely multicultural to begin with, and then a lot of international students too. So what you're saying that even though other programs might have the same intercultural mix in their student body, so math or be it tech programs, any STEM programs, etc., even though they have the same makeup and there is exposure to students from different countries and different environments and culturally, linguistically, etc., what makes a humanities environment different in that respect is that you're talking about issues that revolved around potential cultural differences, et cetera. Whereas if they're sitting in the math classroom, well, even though the makeup is there, but they're talking about just very niche and focused subject. Is that where you're seeing the difference?
Exactly. In all of the years that I have taught at the university level, both in Canada and in the United States at different universities, I have never in my life taught an hour-long lecture where I would speak in front of a large group and just deliver knowledge. It simply does not work like that. We do not work like that in the humanities. I speak in my classrooms for a limited period of time, but always the bulk of the class, and this is what we're trained to do, is discussion among students, with the professor being there to guide the discussion and moderate. But the culture of discussion, the culture of engaging with people, the culture of arguing often quite controversial points without blowing up, without being offensive to anybody. This is absolutely one of the soft skills that you have to pick up if you're going to be successful as a student in the humanities.
Yeah, that's a really, really good point. That, I know, we're starting to see a lot of that nowadays. Obviously, what's really hot right now is, of course, anything that's tech-focused and computer science and anything kind of in the digital space, starting to see where that's coming from. And obviously, one of the main things is that tech has been a very kind of insular kind of really self-focused kind of sphere, right? That doesn't actually have, that doesn't even have conversations with itself, let alone with outside departments. And so obviously there's been this kind of constant conception that STEM and humanities are basically kind of like oil and water. These are just, they just don't mix. They're two opposite ones. So, I mean, I'd be curious to know your thoughts on that. And I'm curious to know, because I think that you have a bit of connection. I've heard that there might be someone in your household who's a little bit more on the STEM space, or a little bit more maybe kind of, you know, scientific oriented, or perhaps more math oriented. How do you kind of bridge that gap? And how do you literally live that kind of dichotomy on a daily basis? So do you find yourselves kind of constantly at odds, let's say, with your husband, or do you learn from each other in real ways? I'm curious to know.
This just got very personal very fast.
Yes, it did.
That's okay. So, my husband's PhD is in statistics, and after he graduated, he decided not to go into academia. He went into the industry because he just doesn't enjoy teaching at all. We often have students from engineering programs or from computer programming programs come to our humanities classes. I have to say that those students always do amazingly well in the humanities classes. I love having them. They are trained in their programs to have a very logical, very organized mind. And many people, for some reason, are surprised to know that you have to have a very logical and a very organized mind to be successful in the humanities. And so when those students come to us, they have a great experience. And I, as a teacher, have a great experience having them in our classrooms, because they have an enormous lot to contribute. And so this kind of an interaction between people who specialize in the humanities and people who specialize in often very hardcore sciences is extremely fruitful, and it makes for a wonderfully, wonderfully rich classroom, and also for a very intellectually rich and rewarding marriage, because my husband is very interested in my research. He reviews all of my books that are published in English, and when I publish in Spanish, I have to retell him, and he's fascinated, and that, of course, happens because my research is so fascinating to anybody. Yeah, and so there's definitely shouldn't be any, all of the ideas about the war between the humanities and the STEM fields are actually quite invented, because when we do come together with the people in the STEM fields, it's always a fantastic experience.
Awesome. That's really cool. Curious to know, where do you think, I mean, you mentioned the war, obviously, and that concept of a war. I'm curious to know, you know, I've been thinking a lot about this. Where does it actually where does it actually come from? Who's propagating these ideas, right? Some from somewhere. Really just curious to know what your thoughts are. And I mean, I'm just going to jump in and say, I know this is not a political podcast or anything like that, but I think I know you're a little bit kind of politically active, or at least kind of engaged and aware, especially in the US where you live. Recently, there was these like massive headlines that, you know, Marco Rubio, who was running for president, kind of famously made a declaration that welders make more than philosophers, which was obviously beyond extremely wrong. But aside from it, it's just a really, really good example at the very highest levels of kind of this continuous kind of propagation of separation of two kind of fields. And just, I guess, maybe it's just a very conservative kind of economics and politics, right? So I don't know what your thoughts are on that.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. That is precisely what lies at the root of the problem, because when you manage to pit people against each other, and when you manage to propagate the idea that they are supposed to hate each other and be at loggerheads, it's so much easier to exploit both groups.
True, true.
Because they are distracted by hating each other and thinking that one of the groups is stealing resources or jobs or whatever from the other group, when in reality, that is absolutely not the case. Any functioning society is supposed to have, especially in the modern world, a robust group of people in the fields of technology, in the fields of medical sciences, in engineering, all fields of sciences. And at the same time, that same society absolutely needs people who work in the realm of developing ideas, generating ideas, disseminating knowledge. And it's only when everybody works together without being allowing themselves to be led down the path of this completely fake animosity, that is when we're going to achieve the best possible results.
And I'm seeing that, you know, obviously universities are trying to do something about the issue, right? And sometimes looks, you know, more effective and efficient where they're allowing for cross-disciplinary interaction and integrating into programs. We don't see a lot of that yet. We really, we don't. And in Canada, we really, really don't. And I know that you had given me a couple of examples in the US and even at your university, which is amazing. But what I'm often seeing is, as I said, knee-jerk reactions. So for example, specifically within departments that used to be, you know, their own departments for literature and language, you know, we saw at McGill, which was tragic, just amalgamating everything into one and seeing that maybe, I don't know, would join forces and some cuts, maybe at least, you know, salvaging some part of it, which was, as I said, really disappointing to see. But interesting and timely for the podcast today was what already happened. I'm not sure if it's in the talks and already happened at your sister university, which just came out today. So I'd love for you to tell us about it. I'm not quite sure that Stefano knows about it. Not only describe what's happening, but also your passionate take on the knee-jerk reaction, or I don't know how well thought this has been. So tell us about what's happening at your sister university in this respect.
Yes, our sister university has been suffering from loss of enrollment, all kinds of administrative issues, a very low morale among faculty and employers for a very long time. So they have been trying to address this issue, especially with a really dramatic drop in enrollments. And of course, the easiest way to address an issue is just to tinker with the outward structure without going into any deeper structural changes that are needed. And so today we got word that the university is looking at the possibility of melding the departments of arts, design, architecture, music, performing arts, theater and dance, et cetera, into one large school that is going to be called School of Creativity. Yeah, which of course, when I heard about it, creativity is something that I associate with the kindergarten level. Like toddlers need to be creative. Let's go do something creative right now. This is not a scholarly term that really is going to attract the attention of people who are looking for something more serious than this childish tinkering in something. And also look at the workplace. I mean, you should know about this a lot more than I do. But when a person comes to you and says that I graduated from a school of creativity, what are their chances in the job market as opposed to a person who says I graduated from college? You know, if we're trying to make our students more competitive, not less, is that really the way to do that? To me, it seems like a move that actually cheapens what we do. It actually tries to lure people in under false pretenses of offering something cute and even childish in a way. But I really fail to see how this is going to improve anybody's chances of being successful professionally.
But what was there? Was there any, you just got an email that was informing everybody about it?
It's an article that appeared in the, this is the talks are being held. The administration is trying to get the Board of Trustees to approve this plan. And the administration says that the faculty seems to be very happy about the change. What is really happening, the actual need to meld all of these programs together is obviously simply to save on the salaries for the departmental chairs, the salaries to the deans, the salaries to administrative assistants.
Oh, and then it just becomes one?
Of course, absolutely. Oh. So you just lose half of the administrative assistants, then the remaining people have to do more work for the same kind of pay, but you make it kind of attractive and you justify all of this by the need to give it a new and a very cute name. And that's the extent of the change. And obviously, I'm personally not happy about that because I don't see that this leads into a really positive direction of actual change.
That's really interesting. I would be curious to know, do you think that it is your responsibility as a professor to be, well, you mentioned that when you meet with prospective students and their parents, you talk to them about the job market and the prospects, et cetera. Do you think it lies within the realm of a professor's responsibility to just integrate that into just the rhetoric and everything across the, you know, sort of student journey and, you know, the programs and the classes? Is it something that academics should be thinking about and should be bringing up and should be talking to students about? Should they just wait for students to approach them? Should there be, does it lie just with the responsibility realm of career services, which I'm sure we can all agree are a complete waste of resources as it stands right now. And we'll talk about it in other podcasts. Where do you think the responsibility of a professor starts, lies, and ends? And if there is a responsibility, maybe you will say there's none, but if you think that there is, what would be your advice or what would be your call to action to fellow academics listening to this right now?
At my university, we used to have this great practice where each of the professors was assigned a certain number of students. And so we had all of the majors and minors in our program assigned to a professor. And the professor would guide these students through the program. So we would do the advising for our students. The professors love that. We love doing that. It's really useful because we can take the student from the beginning of the program to the end of the program. We can talk to them about their career prospects. We can help them organize their academic career, the courses they're taking. This duty was taken away from us. The university decided it would make more sense to hire professional HR people. And so they were brought and all of these duties were shipped out to those professional HR people, which I'm sure that they're trying very hard to advise students well, but they will never be able to do as good of a job of it as I do because they have no idea how our program works. They are not intimately involved in guiding these students on a daily basis. They don't know the students. They don't know what each student needs. They don't see them in the classroom every single day. So we're trying to wrestle back this job away from those professional advisors or professional counselors. But unfortunately, this was one of the best things about our program, the personal relationship that each student could develop with the professor to guide them through the entire career. This has been wrestled away from us. And this is not our decision. So professors want to do that. We do think that we have an obligation to the students to do this. But we have to fight for it very hard, and we have to do it by somehow subverting the decisions of the administration, and because this is what we think is the best for the students and for the program.
Okay, but to play devil's advocate with that line of thinking, you're also not, and I'm reflecting on my years in university, and I know, Stefano, your experiences as well, because we've spoken about them quite a bit, and of course, job seekers that we meet on a daily basis. And you are atypical in a way, because you do not live in an academic bubble, and a bubble exists, right? Even with your research, you write your research with, you know, a connection to the world and not just the connection to a small bubble and a small group of people. You obviously educate yourself on what's happening in the world, what's happening in the job market, even in areas that are not pertinent to you, but you have this intellectual curiosity and you're interested in what's happening. So it makes you equipped and potentially providing that advice. You're able to think, okay, well, you could potentially be suitable for a career in ABC, or this is what you could look at. But do you really think that your fellow academics and other academics are across the board equipped to be making those suggestions and advice? Because very often, I mean, I saw it in business schools where a lot of our professors came from, you know, having worked in the field, but a lot of academics in humanities haven't worked outside of the university setting, even part-time jobs, even anything. So what do you think makes them equipped? Not that your HR professionals and career services are equipped, no, but what do you think makes the academics, many, not yourself, think apart from yourself, equipped to be given realistic, tangible advice to their students?
This is definitely a problem that does exist, and I would be very happy, because we often see people wonder what it is that professors do and why it, right. Yeah, why it is that our research is relevant to anybody, because sometimes the topics sound quite arcane and people have no idea why anybody should be dedicating this life to that and their lives to that, and especially why the public should pay for the kind of research, either through tuition money or through taxes if it's a public institution. I absolutely think that academics should be doing a much better job disseminating their ideas to the general audiences. I do that all the time, and this doesn't happen nearly often enough.
Right.
That's very unfortunate. And I definitely think that we shouldn't believe that it is somehow beneath us to bring our scholarship to the people outside of the campuses. And also it's very important for us to educate ourselves on what is happening out in the job market and whether we're guiding the students correctly. But what happens is that there's so much rhetoric of animosity against academia and against professors. So many people just lock themselves in the bubble because they think that reaching out is useless anyways. And that obviously contributes to the problem.
And you know what's interesting is that it's definitely the case, and you're absolutely right. And very often when you speak to, well, not only academics, but students in the humanities departments, and I would even say, thinking back to, you know, my friends and my acquaintances, especially students that continue past the bachelor's degree and you know, go on to get a master's degree, such as you, Stefano, but then weren't looking to stay in academia, they have this disdain against the business world, and they talk about the business world, right, with a lot of, you know, the rhetoric is negative, right? So not just academics, but the students as well. And then what's ironic is that they end up working in the business world, because it's still business world, but then they're aiming for roles that very often, and I'm generalizing, they don't have much of an impact, right? Don't have a big impact because of that disdain that's created, as you said, very often by the professors, because they are so disconnected, you know, ideologically opposed. And then that somehow impacts the students too. So that's why I'm wondering how academics can kind of snap out of that bubble and thinking for the greater good of their students that will be going into the job market, right?
Yeah, there are many very artificial barriers that are often created. I'm very fortunate in that my sister happens to be in the business world. And so whenever I talk to her, we discover very, very often how many of the issues that she faces in her job are extremely similar to the issues that I face, and how many similarities there are in what we do. And so if people had more exposure to just finding out about people in different fields, then they wouldn't have this knee-jerk rejection of anything that seems to them to be so alien and different. And I think that the barrier between academia and the business world is completely artificial and shouldn't be there, the same as the barrier between the humanities and the STEM fields.
Agree. Yes. Very well said. That was awesome. What a good closing note. That's like a good soundbite. Very nice. Thank you again, Dr. Bajanova, for joining us today. That was awesome. I'm still trying to get past HR people inside academia. That just sounds like a horrible big mess. But we'll leave you with that. Thank you for that amazing. Thank you for taking
thank
the time.
Thank you so much. This was very enjoyable. Thank you.
Oh, it's a pleasure. We need more people like you. We need more professors like you. So thank you for taking the time. Enjoy the rest of your day. And next up, we'll have some more really, really awesome guests joining us really soon on the podcast. Stay tuned, guys. I'll tell you no matter.